all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We're going to bring you today a couple of different stories. The first one's going to be about Team Rubicon. We're going to talk to somebody who went on some Team Rubicon missions and talk about what the value of those is, the kind of work they did, how you get involved. You know, in the good old days, the VSOs had a post down the street, and everybody kind of knew what they were involved in, and we're certainly appreciative of our VSO sponsors. But today, veteran organizations have taken on different types of roles, and we've talked to folks like Team Red, White, and Blue in the past, and we've talked about Team Rubicon before, but this is, I think, the first time we've actually talked to somebody who went on a recent disaster mission with Team Rubicon. So I think you're going to find that interesting. And then the second one is being brought to you because, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, we brought to you a program on the Navy's new littoral combat ships, LCSs, and in particular the USS Detroit was steaming by where we were at, and we got to interview the first captain of that ship. Well, 6 years later now, I suppose it is, and those LCS ships have turned out to be a disaster, a huge government waste. So we're going to bring you an update on an old program that we did because we think it's our responsibility to correct this situation and make sure you know what the truth is about the LCS ships and the government waste. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today a Navy veteran, Tim Kudelak. Tim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thank you, Jim. It's an honor.
Well, we're glad to have you on, TK, and talk a little bit about your experiences. But something that caught my eye was your work that you're doing with Team Rubicon. So there's going to be some focus on that for our veteran radio listeners. But, Tim, why don't we start with you explaining to folks how a nice kid from you ended up in the Navy.
Well, a nice kid, huh?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, this paragraph I'm about to read you right now, I mean, explains it all, Jim. I was actually Security Forces in the United States Navy from 2004 to 2008. I was also Master at Arms, which is really weird. This is just caught my ear right when he said it, because the reason why I had to join the Navy was because I get in a lot of trouble. So, you know, back in those days,
you were given a choice.
Oh yeah, I had no choice. Absolutely. That's right. So it tripped me out, you know, the first year of being a Navy police officer, being in the front seat of a cop car instead of the back.
what's that about? The ride's all entirely different.
That's right. It sure was. And you know, even you know, when I was passing other of my cohorts and everything in their police cars, you know, I was still checking my pockets and making sure I was
all good. Yeah, exactly.
I was also involved, you know, one of three Navy ships. We did a couple months in Hurricane Katrina as well, which was devastating to say the least.
And yep. And where were you stationed during this period?
For my station was Norfolk, Virginia, and Little Creek Base, Virginia. And then where we were stationed for Katrina was St. Bernard Parish.
So, you know, this is one of these things where you spend some time in the service, and here you spend 4 years in, but it kind of has an impact on the whole rest of your life, doesn't it?
It does, and I'll be able to talk about that in a little bit. It's a whole line of just pain and suffering, as well as, you know, joy and hardships and just maintaining survivability in your head. Sometimes, Jim, it's crazy.
Well, and Tim is also a business owner. We're going to talk about that a little bit. He lives now up in what we'd call northern Michigan in God's country.
That's right.
And one of the things that caught my eye, Tim, was your involvement with Team Rubicon that I wanted to talk about. And and for those who don't know, Team Rubicon's been around since about, I think 2010 or something.
2010, correct.
It's had more than 1,140 operations. It's been to more than 40 different sites around the world helping folks. And it was recently down in, troops deployed, if you will, down to Florida for Hurricane Ian. And even this interview almost didn't happen because, Tim almost got deployed off to California for a Team Rubicon, project. But let's talk first, Tim. How did you end up getting involved with Team Rubicon?
Well, it's a lot of veterans and first responders and that join Team Rubicon, as well as a lot of kick-ass civilians involved. So my story is probably the same as a lot of people's stories that are involved, is that I am 100% rated through the VA for PTSD. I was going through about 8 to 10 years after Katrina of straight hell in my head mentally, secondary to my skill sets. After I discharged from the military, I became a firefighter and an EMT, and my last job before I started my businesses and organization was I was picking up the homicide-suicide case for Washtenaw County. So all my eyes saw was darkness, and my head was just full of despair and pain. It was rough, Jim. And it started to influence me greatly mentally and into a suicidal stupor for years. In that time, I just kept myself busy running organizations and doing what I could just to keep out of my head. I ran an organization downstate called Miles for Medics. I used to raise money for paramedics, firefighters, and police officers that have died in line of duty because my father for community EMS down in Southfield was almost killed on scene. So, you know, it was just me keeping busy and doing 48-hour shifts and, you know, just not really dealing with the pain that I felt and actually exacerbating it by getting to more of these skill sets when I wasn't ready. So what we most miss, Jim, is camaraderie, and Team Rubicon definitely provides that for me. I'm sorry, I'm a little emotional right now.
I think it's important for people to hear that, you know, hey, you can be struggling with some stuff, but there's still purpose in life, and there's things that'll give you purpose. And I think that's one of the real differences with today's veteran organizations, whether it's Team Rubicon or Team Red, White, and Blue. It's a whole lot different than, you know, going to the VFW hall or something like that. And
absolutely.
So who said to you, or did you reach out to them? How did you get kind of, hey, maybe I'm going to give this Team Rubicon thing a try?
I think this was meant to be, Jim, because you just mentioned them. Team Red, White, and Blue, Detroit chapter. Shane, the president there, I was starting to hang out with them a little bit here and there, but more towards like the Milford areas doing the rucks and everything. And so I was looking through their sites and it took me through a loophole, and that's how I found Team Rubicon.
And let's talk a little bit about what the purpose of Team Rubicon is, what it mobilizes in response to.
Sure, absolutely. So Team Rubicon is a completely volunteer disaster relief organization made up of veterans, first responders, and kick-ass civilians. Team Rubicon travels around the country to different natural disasters, and all the volunteers are able to sign up for any disaster, and Team Rubicon pays for the plane ticket, your room, your boarding, your food. Some deployments might be, you know, you might be sitting in a tent in a parking lot, you know, in the cold. That's where you sleep, eating, you know, MREs. Some, you know, you might be you know, at the basement of a church, you know, getting stuff catered to you. You have no idea how the mission is going to be. And I think that's what grasps a lot of our attention as veterans, first responders, civilians, is the philanthropy part of it. Just getting out there and being part of something bigger than ourselves, and you know, putting on our big boy pants and just being decent human beings and helping our brothers and sisters.
Well, one of the things that happens too is you actually accomplish stuff, right? I mean, you know, we're going to talk about your specific deployments, but when you go into a disaster zone, there's so much just basic work that has to be done. But at the end of the day, end of the week, you can say, hey, we've cleared this from there to there. And there are something like 158,000 veterans who participate in Team Rubicon. Mm-hmm. And these volunteers are called Gray Shirts. So you've been on a number of these deployments, Tim. Tell us about maybe your first and maybe your last one.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just started with Team Rubicon I started probably February of 2022, but my first deployment wasn't until October 8th. And September 28th was when Hurricane Ian hit. So we were deployed a week later. So I was deployed first to Polk County, which is not too far from Ground Zero, Fort Myers area, everything like that. So basically what we were doing around there was, you know, going around to people's houses and seeing if they needed, you know, Sawyer work, which is tree cutting, if they needed any muck outs, which is cleaning out houses of drywall and flooring and removing objects of their house, taking it to the curb for them, cleaning debris from outside. I can't tell you, Jim. I mean, it's surreal. And I've been to a lot of natural disasters even before Team Rubicon, but and everyone doesn't get easier. It's just you're the survivors, the families, the neighbors, and the communities just blow your mind. I mean, the stories that I heard, the tears that soaked through my clothing from survivors and myself alike. I mean, everything was just surreal, bro. And it takes effect on your heart and your soul, and it does something to you, man. It just makes you want to do more, and it makes you want to reach out more, and makes you want to preach to, you know, others to, you know, do the same and try to get them involved in whatever you're interested in. And it's just it's something that's saving my life, literally, in a small way.
Well, I can tell it makes your heart swell. I mean, it's the sort of thing where you're no longer focused on yourself. You're focused on these other folks who are really in a bad way, man. And maybe it makes you realize, hey, you know, I might have it a little bit better than that guy who just had his whole house wiped out.
Yes, sir.
But part of this, too, you mentioned the camaraderie. Team Rubicon is deployed a little bit like the military. There are units here, right? You don't go off on yourself by yourself. Tell us about how the structure works.
Well, I mean, it's pretty much FEMA structure. It's you know, you got to have your ICS, your NIMS. You have to learn about all the structure, the command structures. You have your planning, your logistics. I mean, you got your command centers. You got your heavy equipment, your Sawyer teams, your RUC teams. You got everybody in different teams. You got everybody learning different leadership positions. And if you don't know your leadership position, you're being put in it anyway. And then your team around you helps you through it. It's a building and growth relationship every day with these brothers and sisters that you're working with to help people out. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing.
Tell us a little bit, Tim, if you would, about the folks you deployed with for Team Rubicon down to Hurricane Ian in October.
Absolutely. So they're from everywhere. They are literally from all over the country. We can be deployed at a minute's notice. They are people that have no homes. They are people that have lots of money. They are people that are middle class. They're people that hurt. They're people that are happy. There are people like Israel Aid. They're from Israel. They came over and helped for 2 months in the U.S., Hurricane Ian. They're another organization across the pond. It's just good people, man. And, you know, thinking of a military structured group, you think of military structured people. So my first thought, Jim, was, man, we're going to have a hell of a lot of alphas in this group, and there's going to be too many Chiefs and not enough Indians.
Right,
and you
right.
know what? I was completely wrong. Everybody is genuine and looking to really help. And if you get that one or two that isn't, you know, that they never show back up. They know.
Yeah, they're weeded out just like they normally are.
Absolutely.
So for our veteran radio listeners, we're talking to Tim Kudelak, who's a Navy veteran who volunteers with Team Rubicon. And as he said, the volunteers are reimbursed for expenses, airfare, you know, housing, meals, whatever may be taken care of. But they're not paid. And you can learn more about Team Rubicon by going to their website, teamrubiconusa.org. Tim, you've done this once. I know this interview almost didn't happen because you were on call to go off to California. Is this something that you see yourself continuing to do, like you almost answered the call today?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You'll get a text message, you know, a flood happens in Kentucky and they want guys to go out, guys and girls to go out. I mean, this is something that I wouldn't say is a hobby. It's more of a passion. Whenever I have time and the means to do it, I'm going to be on that plane. And they do reimburse you for everything if you do pay. But if you don't have the money as well, I want to make clear, you don't have to pay. You don't have to pay them back, any of that stuff. They'll pay for you. There's no reimbursements. They'll pay for you.
Well, explain to us a little bit, what are you getting out of it? What do you get out of spending time on a Team Rubicon deployment?
That's a damn good question, Jim. I'm a selfish gentleman with my mental health because it has almost taken my life many times. So I do this selfishly. I do this for my head. It makes me feel good going out and doing good for others. And I think that's what a lot of people, I don't want to say that as fact, but I think a lot of people, they hurt and it makes them feel better by doing better for others. So that's literally what it is. It's a selfish matter for me.
Yeah. I think volunteering for in any way, shape or form, whether it's at the Humane Society with Animals or something like Team Rubicon, helps you realize we're all part of a bigger thing here and does help you mentally. So am I correct, TK, that you would recommend to other vets that maybe they look into participating here with Team Rubicon?
Absolutely. Most definitely. I mean, if you're looking for, you know, a brother to call after an operation or a brother or sister to call, you know, just the call. I mean, these are people that you can make for lifetime friends, you know, and family. And I still get texts, and I've been with other organizations. You know, you go do your job, you love on each other when you're there, and then you don't really see each other or hear from each other until your next stop. It's different with these guys.
And how long were you? How long do these deployments go? I mean, hey, I may have a week, but I'm not sure I got a month. What's the time frame here?
Absolutely. So they have a saying there called changing your socks. So basically, after a 10-day deployment, 7 to 10-day deployment, they want you to go home. They want you to get mentally refit, debrief yourself, you know, chillax a little bit, and then you can sign up again and come back down, you know, a week later or whatever if they need you.
And Tim, how did you go about signing up to do this?
So you said it just yourself, my friend. You went to teamrubiconusa.org, and then you go and click on to the volunteer, and it'll give you all the instructions. Basically, they're going to pay for your background check if you can't afford it, and then they'll give you, you know, instructions to take your, you know, ICS 100, ICS 700. Those are the only two that you need to actually get into Team Rubicon, as well as, you know, just a small class, you know, letting you know what Team Rubicon's about. So basically, you can, if you put your mind to it, you can get everything done in one day and get it all sent in. And then it usually takes, sometimes it's taken as little as a week and you're on a deployment, or it could take, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, but it doesn't take very much time at all. And you can also advance with Team Rubicon. There's people in the command centers, and there's so many different classes and different things that we can learn and upgrade our skill sets, and it's just it really is a good military structure.
Well, that's a good lead into a question that I was thinking about, and that is skill sets. Hey, I'm not a bulldozer operator or heavy equipment operator, or maybe I don't operate a chainsaw. What level of skill do I have to be of interest to Team Rubicon?
Absolutely. Okay, that's a great question. So you do have to be over 18 to join, and then there is no age limit after that. They do not care if you have a disability. They don't care what skill sets you have. You have a job with Team Rubicon. I know an 80-year-old man that's out there. That's a master sawyer that teaches others how to chainsaw and stuff like that. That's out there cutting trees, you know, on these ops. And then there's a young lady in a wheelchair with a service dog that, you know, is in the command center and doing planning logistics, you know. And then there's people with all different skill sets, EMTs and stuff like that, that we can be used out there. You do not have to have a certain skill set. They will train you.
Yeah, I think sometimes people say, well, I'm a handy, but I'm not a – you know, I'm not a finished carpenter, or I'm not a, you know, I can drive a truck, but I'm not really a great operator. So I think that's great to hear that there's all levels of need that can be put to work at Team Rubicon.
Absolutely. If you got a heart and half a brain, you're good.
Hey, Tim, I want to switch gears a little bit and give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the businesses that you've got going now. I know you've got two of them, but as importantly, I guess I want to ask before we get into the specifics of it, you know, you got out, you had some struggles. Why did you move towards, hey, I want to be an entrepreneur, I want to be a business owner myself? Talk a little bit about that transition.
Absolutely. So with the disorders that I have, it was getting really, really hard to do a 9-to-5. Some days you can't get out of bed, you're crying, you're in pain, you know, you're mentally wanting to make this your last day on earth. So I had to start my own business. My first one was Got Your Six Power Washing. Then what I could do is I could hire people. And if I have that lost day, you know, I can send them out to go get those jobs done and still be able to put food on their table as well as mine. So now that's what I do. I just stay busy. I can't work a 9-to-5 job. There's just no way. There's no way I'd be able to see how I'm going to be the next day mentally with these disorders.
Well, and I think that, you know, the power washing and getting into a small business where you can be a little more in control of your own schedule is really a useful situation for somebody who's balancing all those other issues, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's something that I like, you know, power washing, you clean things, and it's so satisfying, and it really helps my head, and that's what I do with Got Your Six Power Washing is I hire other veterans, you know, that have disorders and can't do 9-to-5 jobs. And, you know, they put a set of earplugs in and that's it. They don't have to deal with me. They just do their job and easy day squared away.
Yeah. Well, sometimes that's part of it too is, hey, I don't want to deal with a boss. I don't want to deal with, you know, I'll put the earplugs in. It's going to be noisy. But again, it's a job where at the end of the day, you can look back and say, that's what we accomplished. And I think that helps a lot of people.
Absolutely, Jim. You're completely correct on that.
Now, Tim, you also got involved in a new business some might feel as, well, that's a little bit different than what he was doing. So TK, talk about it.
Well, I moved up to Houghton Lake about 2.5 years ago to save my life, actually, trees and water and get away from the cities and get my mind right. And this community had saved my life, by the way, has been great. So I met a young lady here, a really good friend of mine. She's become a really good friend of mine. And she's a cosmetologist and she's just amazing at her skill set. And it's not the skill set that I'm investing in, Jim. It's really her heart. Anybody that sits in her chair, and she's involved with my organization as well, the veteran organization, and anybody that sits in her chair or anybody that talks to her, they cannot help but just to feel magnetized to her. I mean, she is such a beautiful heart, and I can't say so much more for her. I mean, she just loves everybody. She's taken care of me a lot with my head, you know, and gotten me into this position to where I can do a lot of this stuff with confidence. So basically, we're opening a veteran-owned, woman-owned hair salon. It's called blended lines. Blended lines meaning, you know, we're blending people, services, departments, agencies. We're all one. And it's going to be a military and public safety and first responder themed salon. So, you know, people from local departments can come in and drop off their patch, and we'll put it in a shadow box on the wall. If you have a picture of your loved one, we have a whole wall of honor, you know, that you can put a picture of your loved one that passed away that was in the military, public safety. Just a lot of stuff like that we want to do for these communities around here. And it doesn't have to be, you know, a straightforward veteran for veteran business. You know, we can do things for veterans, first responders, anywhere in any aspect of life.
Yeah, it's going to be veteran friendly here at Blended Lines Salon and at Got Your Six Power Washing. Kim, think back 10 years, a decade ago, where you were at, where your head was at, and where you are today. Pretty damn amazing, isn't it?
It really is. I wouldn't expect that I'd be here, Jim.
And I think that's one of those messages you try to get out to our veteran radio listeners, is that, you know, a lot of things can change. Don't give up hope. Don't succumb. Keep fighting. Look for opportunities that'll help you, whether it be changing locations, getting out of the city, starting your own business, small business so that you don't have to deal with the boss, finding some good friends, and getting involved in something bigger than yourself, like Team Rubicon. And it's also a bigger purpose, because you have the right to do some bragging about your son, don't you?
Oh man, absolutely.
Go ahead. My son,
all right, cool. This is cool. My son Julian, like I said, you know, I had a pretty rough past. So my son Julian was conceived on a reservation in New Mexico. So he's off a reservation. I didn't get him till he was about 10 years old. And a res boy in a white man's world, you know, it's a whole different world. So it was rough. And me being a military dad, strict and everything like that, it was hard, man. And we've been through a whole lot together. And he's turned 18 now. And on his birthday, he went to MEPS.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's it really says something when he's looked at his father and said, I want to join up. I want to join the military. So, and I don't remember seeing which service he joined.
Oh yeah, he's joining Army, and he still hasn't graduated high school yet. So that's another 3 months until high school's graduation, and then he'll be shipped off. So he hasn't went off yet.
Well, every moment of it's as you know, precious. And again, one of those things where you look back and say, "Gosh, you know, 8 years of this life was 10 years ago, a decade ago. Yeah. Life was so different. I was in such a different place." And man, it's great to be where you're at, isn't it, TK?
It's a lot better than it was, my friend.
Absolutely. Well, we appreciate Tim Kudelak coming on and talking to Veterans Radio, talking primarily about Team Rubicon and what it does and how it does it and the value to him. But we also appreciate you being so candid about your service and some of the struggles, but getting on the other side as well. So, Tim, thanks for the time today.
Absolutely. I just want to give a little shout out to you, my friend. Thank you for what you do for us. And also, my organization is called Got Your Six Veteran Community Organization. It's here in Roscommon County, Michigan. My mission statement is I give veterans stuff to do to stay out of their head, which in turn helps me stay out of mine. So we just go out and we do a bunch of stuff. We got sponsors and businesses that will help out.
You got a Facebook or a website that they can follow you on?
Yep, they can go right on Facebook, look up Got Your Six Veterans.
Perfect. That's what we wanted to get across.
I was saying, I just want to tell these warriors out there, you know, just stay strong. No more funerals.
You got it, Tim. We really like being able to bring to you these veteran stories. Yeah, this was about Team Rubicon, but it was also about a Navy veteran who was really candid about some of the stuff he struggled with and how he's working to overcome it. So these are real stories of real veterans, and I think that's one of the things Dale and the Veterans Radio team does best. So real pleased to be able to bring you that story. We'll hear a few words from our sponsors, and we'll be back on the other side to talk about Navy wasted dollars.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Okay, as I said at the outset, this is a sort of a confessional interview that we did here, and we want to bring back to you because in 2016, I was all over the idea of this new littoral combat ship platform that the Navy was rolling out, and it sounded like it was a great mix of capabilities and technology package on what this ship could do. And as I say, I bought in hook, line, and sinker, to the point that I interviewed Commander Michael Desmond, who was the commanding officer of the USS Detroit Littoral Combat Ship, or LCS, who told us about all these great capabilities, and heck, I was drooling over the whole interview because I thought it was so cool. Well, it didn't turn out to perform the way it was designed or as anticipated, and notwithstanding me buying in, the reality is much different. So we thought it would be useful to bring forward to you and kind of give a retrospective look at how the LCS platforms worked, and we're bringing you somebody from the Hudson Institute who really is pretty knowledgeable on this, but unfortunately he highlights the amount of government waste involved in this program. You're going to find it interesting. You probably didn't get sucked into it the way I do, but it's probably a cautionary tale for future DOD plans and Navy plans for these great ships that are really expensive but don't always work the way they're designed. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Brian Clark. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He's an expert in naval operations, electronic warfare, autonomous systems, military competitions, and war gaming. Hey, Brian, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
Well, let me tell folks, if they're not familiar with the Hudson Institute, that it was formed about 62 years ago. It's a think Washington, D.C. kind of think tank. Brian comes to this with time at the Navy, where he was in director of CNO Strategic Actions Group and a strategic planner. He then did time at DOD in the Office of Net Assessment and in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. So you're pretty deep in Navy matters and policy, big picture items. That kind of a fair summary of your career?
Yeah, it is. You know, so I do focus a lot on Navy, being a retired Navy guy. And I also focus on some of the kind of emerging areas of technology and warfare. So, you know, unmanned systems, artificial intelligence, electronic warfare, 5G, you know, some of those new technologies that might be relevant to the military. So, yeah, so I kind of focused on those areas, but Navy occupies a lot of my time.
Well, this is why I wanted to focus on that, because this is a kid who went to the University of Idaho, and I always think it's hilarious when I talk to these Navy guys, and they're from states where there's no oceans, there's no big water around. How'd you go from Idaho to the Navy?
Yeah, well, so my stepfather was in the Navy, but more importantly, my best friend growing up in high school joined the Navy, enlisted in the Navy, and so he convinced me to join as well, because we both got like $50 signing bonuses if we did it as, you know, friends. So that's what did it, and then I just kind of stayed with it.
Well, you found out it's something you're good at and you enjoyed, and he went on, Brian went on to get his master's in national security strategy, and he's attended the U.S. National War College. He's got a lot of this kind of experience. But I wanted to have him on because of something that I did, about 6 years ago. 6 years ago, Veterans Radio talked to the then captain of the USS Detroit as it came through the Great Lakes after being built in Marionette, Wisconsin. And it was one of those Freedom-class littoral combat ships which got built, and I think there's maybe 14, 15 of them. Great ballyhoo at the time. These were going to be the new and upcoming ships that could to go into shallower waters. They were supposed to have this great capability, modular capability, that they could handle different types of platforms from missiles to helicopters and everything in between. Boy, it was really talked up as a great new step forward for the Navy, and now we're 6 years later, and the Navy is proposing to retire the USS Detroit among nine other Freedom-class LCSs, and they may sell them to the foreign governments, or they may scrap them, or who knows what they're going to do with them exactly at this time. There were 35 of these planned. The Navy invested something like $4.5 billion in this project, but it didn't work out, did it, Brian?
No, it didn't. It worked out in a way. I mean, the Navy is going to get some benefit from these ships at the end. They're not going to get rid of all of them. So they will yield some benefit to the Navy. But, big investment for what in the end is going to be a relatively small number of ships devoted to a pretty limited set of missions.
As you've thought about this as a guy who's really deep in strategic thinking and budgets, what do you think went wrong with the decision? And maybe you can even tell our veteran radio listeners, these are long-term decisions. This was made decades ago. But kind of what went off course?
Well, from the very start, the program had sort of an ill-defined set of missions that it was trying to pursue. And the CONOPs, the tactics they were going to use to pursue them were not really well argued or articulated at the beginning. And so as a result, the ship started out, constantly changing set of requirements. So they were intended initially to go very fast because the argument was that was how they were going to deal with the small boat threat, is to go fast, use their guns to shoot small boats like you'd see with the Iranians in the Persian Gulf. And that they needed to be shallow draft because they were going to operate in close to shore environments like the Persian Gulf or the South China Sea, or maybe the East China Sea, and that they needed to have this ability to take on a changing set of mission systems. So they're going to have these interchangeable mission packages because it's too small a ship to be able to do the three big missions the Navy needed done, which was anti-submarine warfare, mine clearing, and surface warfare or maritime security. And this ship was too small to have all the stuff on it to do all those missions at the same time. So it would change out the mission packages based on what mission was most important at the time. So those were kind of some initial ideas the Navy had, but they hadn't really engaged with the industry people who would build the ships or at the engineers and architects who would design them to figure out if that was feasible. And if it was feasible, is it practical? And as they built the ships and as they tried to field them, they realized that that scheme was neither feasible or practical. And in the end, ended up being very expensive to yield, like I said, a small number of ships in the end that are going to really kind of be focused on a narrow set of missions. So mine clearing is still going to be their kind of main job. And then secondarily, their job is maritime security in kind of the close to shore environment. But anti-submarine warfare fell off the table. And the idea of interchangeable mission packages is off the table as well.
And that really interchangeable mission package was a big part of what LCSs were apparently going to do. And again, that kind of didn't work its way out. Did any of these get deployed overseas?
They have two varieties of LCS. There's one which is a monohull, or it looks like a kind of a traditional warship. And that's the Freedom class. And those have deployed to the South America, Central America, Caribbean. One has deployed overseas to the Persian Gulf. And one has deployed to the Freedom itself, has deployed over to the South China Sea. So they've had some success, but those have been mostly kept close to home because they have a transmission problem that has resulted in a lot of ships being stranded in various places because the transmission has a lot of, you know, ends up failing fairly often. It's just like having a car with a bad transmission. And they've had to go through and replace those transmissions. And so that's really kept those ships from deploying very much. The other flavor of LCS is the Independence class, which is a trimaran. So it's, it looks like a three-hulled ship. It's sort of futuristic looking, very wide. So it's 100 feet wide. So it definitely not like a normal Navy warship. That ship has had more success in deploying overseas. So they've been deploying those, and they're based mostly in San Diego. So they deploy out to the South China Sea, and they've been deploying at a pretty regular tempo over the last 2 years now. And so you've seen, the Navy, you know, put a lot more emphasis on those as your, as the overseas deployers. And they're, and the Navy is saying in the, its most recent plans that it's going to keep at least a dozen of those, of the 16 they built originally or building. They'll keep about a dozen of those Independence class, those trimaran ships. So they've been pretty successful deploying overseas, but again, both classes have not deployed very much considering the classes of ships have been around for 20 years almost. And they put a lot of money into them. The fact that they've gotten, you know, maybe a dozen deployments out of them is not that impressive.
Now, and as somebody who cares about the Navy as you do and understands the costs and the benefits in the Navy planning, talk a little bit about if in your view this should have been caught earlier, correction should have made, or the whole program should be scrapped, although there are still folks who claim, you know, the program shouldn't be scrapped. I guess that raises for me, do you think it should be scrapped?
Yeah, so I think the program shouldn't be scrapped. And one of the main reasons is because the ships that the LCS was intended to replace have already left the fleet. They've already retired, right? So the LCS is intended to replace frigates that were built during the Cold War, the Oliver Hazard Perry class frigates, which did, you know, like escort missions and anti-submarine warfare. But in maritime security and counter piracy in their later years. So they were used a lot for like maritime security type missions in the Persian Gulf, in the Gulf of Aden, you know, during those years. So the LCS still can do that mission, even if it can't do the anti-submarine warfare. The other ships they're intended to replace are the minesweepers that are currently retiring right now out of the fleet. And they're mostly in the Persian Gulf. Almost all of them are based right there in Bahrain. And then the other class of ship they're replacing are the patrol craft, which are also stationed mostly in Bahrain. So those three classes of ships are leaving the fleet or have left the fleet. So you need something to do that job. So the LCSs can do that, albeit in limited numbers. So I think you got to keep them around for that. And the Navy's going to have to do some things to mitigate the liabilities that these ships have. So because neither one of them really is designed for frequent long transits because they've got either the transmission problems with the Freedom class or the Independence class. The Trimaran actually has problems with hull cracking because it's made out of aluminum. Neither ship is really designed for these long back and forths across the ocean. So the Navy's going to have to probably station most of them overseas so they don't have to make those transits and then keep them over there. And then they can do this job, you know, basically local kind of close to shore operations. Which is an important mission for the Navy, and they don't have anything that can do that right now because they're retiring all those ships. So I think you got to keep them around for that reason. And that's why the Navy is arguing they're going to keep, you know, probably half of the original LCS. But that means you're retiring a lot of ships, 16 to 20 ships that have only, you know, in some cases, a few years of service on them. So it's a big waste of money in the end. But you got to keep some of them because there's no alternative.
Yeah, you're keeping your old Chevy because you can't afford the replacement. You know it leaks oil, but you gotta just keep putting oil in it every 2 weeks.
Exactly.
Not the best vehicle to have. It sounds like these are ships that has some degree of functionality, but certainly don't fall into the level of asset that maybe we would expect for the money that we have invested as taxpayers.
Yeah, exactly. So for the missions they're going to end up doing, you know, the Navy could have gotten by with a much less expensive ship that they could have bought, you know, more or less on the open market, because there's even U.S. shipbuilders that build small ships for overseas customers for other countries, you know, that could have been used for these purposes. But the Navy, because they kind of started out with this idea of this very sophisticated ship that was going to go very fast, that was going to do these interchangeable modules, that was going to you know, be able to operate with a lot of automation, you know, all those things drove them towards custom built, as opposed to using something that was pretty close to what was already available in the market. And so they ended up now today with essentially falling back to using those very custom built ships for purposes that they could have used a, you know, ship off the shelf for.
Yeah, we were told back in 2016 that this was a very high-tech ship, that the crew, while smaller, would be very high-tech capable. Did that bear itself out, or, again, did the planning overshoot the mark?
Yeah, so what's interesting is the automation does work. I mean, so the automation in terms of making it so the ship can, you know, run around and do its mission without as many people, that did pan out so that the ships are able to operate with a smaller crew than an equivalent sized ship of the past. So they're about 3,000 tons. The Oliver Hazard Perry class frigates were about 4,000 tons. So, yeah, they're about a quarter, I guess, a third bigger. But the crew of the LCS, the, you know, normal kind of operating crew, is like 50 people, whereas the crew of a Perry frigate was more like 120 people, 130 people. Yeah, so you do have a savings in personnel there. The problem ends up being in maintenance. So to maintain the ship and to do the damage control, but mostly the maintenance, you need a bigger crew. So they've had to augment the crew to be more like 70 people so that they would sufficient people to do the maintenance and actually sustain the ship on a, you know, longer duration deployment. Which, you know, so it's still less people than you would have on an equivalent ship of the past, but it's not as small a crew as that they had originally hoped. And all of those things, in addition to the, you know, the fuel efficiency is pretty low, considered, because they had to make the ships be able to go fast in the original concept. So because the engines are designed for operating at high speed, and because they've got this bigger crew, the operating cost of the ship has gone up. So it costs nearly as much to operate one of these ships as it costs to operate a destroyer, which is a much larger ship. You know, a destroyer today is three times the size of an LCS, but an LCS costs about $60 million a year to operate, and a destroyer costs $70 to $80 million a year to operate. So that's, if you really get Navy officials down and force them to answer, they'll tell you that the main reason they're having to retire these ships is the operating costs are just too high given the benefit or the capability that they provide.
Yeah, and you have to augment the crew almost by half to deal with maintenance issues at a time when
Right. All
of the services are having challenges with their manpower requirements. And again, we're talking for our veteran radio listeners, we're talking to Brian Clark. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He focuses a lot on defense issues, Navy issues, really has a lot of expertise there. And let me tell folks also that this LCS class, the ships are about 400 feet in length. They're a little shorter than that. They displace about 3,400 metric tons. And Brian's mentioned a couple of times that they're supposed to go fast. Well, their top speed is something like 45 knots. So they do go fast, but they also burn up a lot of fuel in doing that. And the ships have some transmission problems and hull problems depending on which of the two classes. As you think your way through this, Brian Clark for the Hudson Institute, do you see, as you look at Navy budgets and plans, that the lessons have been learned here, that the next round of ships being proposed to replace this set, which replaced our frigates and minesweepers and patrol craft, that we've learned the lessons, that maybe there's some off-the-shelf items that work better than the specialty items? How do you read what you're seeing now from the Navy?
Well, Jim, so in part they learned the lesson. So in the newest class of surface ship that they've developed, the new Constellation class frigate, which is going to do the anti-submarine warfare mission that the LCS couldn't do, and also replaces the Perry class frigates on a more one-for-one basis, right? So these new frigates they're developing and are building up in Marinette, Wisconsin. They took the approach of this idea of using off-the-shelf technology. So they went in with the idea that we're going to use an existing frigate design from another country, which many countries have, especially in Europe, have these frigates, frigates of this kind. They ended up selecting the Fremm frigate, which is built by Italy's Fincantieri Shipbuilding. But then they modified that ship so much in the course of the DoD's requirements process that the ship, you know, went from, it's about a 6,500 ton ship in the Italian Navy to be more like an 8,000 ton ship in the U.S. Navy. So it grew by more than a quarter in terms of size and added a bunch of capabilities and you know, requirements and different systems that the original didn't have. So they have this, had a ship off the shelf that would have been a pretty affordable option. And then they larded onto it a lot of new stuff that is going to increase its cost, both to buy it and also to operate it. So we'll see in the end if that ship ends up being a good example of, you know, acquisition reform in action, or if it ends up being another kind of boondoggle like the LCS was. But that's like that's the case study for the United States Navy, is that did we learn the lessons from LCS and apply them in this new frigate program?
Yeah, it's good. As somebody who has such a deep dive in this stuff, as you put out your reports and analysis, what kind of reception does the Hudson Institute receive when trying to communicate both to the Capitol Hill politicians, but the industry probably in general, and the folks over in the Pentagon at DOD? I mean, do you feel like, okay, they are getting our message, we are getting some of this across, or do you look at it and go, man, why did they grow the Constellation class frigate from the off the shelf to the almost another third?
Yeah, I feel like we do get traction with the work that we do. I mean, we've been able to, you know, influence what the Navy is buying, and the Navy and Marine Corps actually as a team are buying. So there's been some good examples of where, you know, we've been able to successfully drive the thinking there, or at least, you know, provide some more visibility to things that they would then, you know, choose to do by themselves. I think what happens here is that even though we've done reports, including reports for the Department of Defense, so the Navy hires us to do work like this. So they ask us for our input. What happens, though, is that those good ideas go into the bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy in this case is what grew, in this case, the frigate requirements to make the ship a third bigger, you know, than it was originally designed to be. Because, you know, there's just nobody is willing to take any risk, and everybody, it's easier to add things than to take things off or to say no. So I think it's the bureaucracy that tends to drive towards making things bigger and more expensive in the U.S. because there's not necessarily the same sense of, you know, economic stress or affordability as you would have in a foreign navy. So foreign navies go in with a cost cap and say this thing cannot cost more than a certain number of dollars or euros. In the United States, it's sort of the requirements first, and then we figure out how much it costs on the back end. And that's kind of the fundamental problem, is the bureaucracy is not driven to think in terms of being economical. They're driven in terms of lowering risk and, you know, preventing somebody from coming back to them with a example of how they failed to, you know, make the ship as survivable as it could be or as lethal as it could be.
Yeah, and we all understand that the U.S. Navy mission requirements are a lot different than the Italian Navy mission requirements. But we're in a world where China and China's demand to control sea power, certainly over in its lanes, is so prevalent. Do you have an unfair question with a few minutes remaining, but can you give us sort of the think tank view on how the U.S. Navy is doing to meet the challenges of the Chinese Navy?
They're doing pretty well, actually. I mean, I think the thing that they're doing well is building a fleet designed to meet the challenge posed by China in an invasion of Taiwan. What they're doing less well is dealing with the China challenge that happens in every other way. So the, you know, island building, the gray zone harassment of our allies, the potential for blockades of Taiwan or of quarantines. The U.S. Navy is not really building a fleet that's able to deal with those problems very well, but they are focused on this idea of dealing with the invasion problem, which they're doing a good job at, arguably. So I think, you know, it's a matter too of where the incentives are. And you know, what's the strategy? What are our priorities with regard to China? And I think right now the priority has been focused on the invasion, and therefore that fleet is what they're building. And that's things like LCS are not as important to that mission. Therefore, they tend to be easy to take off the table. But maybe those things like LCS would be important if you were worried more about dealing with the, you know, the Chinese harassment in the gray zone rather than, you know, the invasion of Taiwan.
If you had a piece of advice for them in that area, what would it be?
It would be to sort of expand the scope of scenarios that we're planning for with regard to China, you know, and think about balancing the needs for a blockade and the needs for a quarantine or the needs to protect our allies from harassment against the needs for an invasion to make sure that we're not, you know, putting all our eggs in one basket.
It's always great to hear from experts like Brian Clark of the Hudson Institute, who really knows his Navy issues. So he schooled us both on the LCS class, sort of Navy procurement, and what's going on with China. We can't bring you these great stories without the help of our sponsors like NVBDC.org, the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, VSOs, Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, the Graf O'Hara VFW Post, and the American Legion Irwin Preskin Post in Ann Arbor. So we really do appreciate us. Check us out on Facebook. Look at our stories that we post on veteransradio.net every Tuesday, and stay in touch. And if you have any program ideas, send them to dale@veteransradio.net. I also want to thank Tim Kudelak, who talked to us about Team Rubicon and gave us some personal insights as well. So those are the real veteran stories that we like to bring to you. Very interesting and gives a lot of hope, to everybody. So stay in touch. If you have any program ideas, let us know. As I said, look at our Facebook. Check out our website, veteransradio.net. And we're on your station because of our sponsors. If you want to help out, go to the website, click on it, sponsor us. It can be $100 or $1,000, whatever it might be. Dale and I would certainly appreciate it. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.